Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our guest tonight is Professor William Andrews. Bill Andrews is the Senior Associate Dean and Professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's much in the news today, or this week, because of the release by Oxford University Press of a book called The Curse of Caste or The Slave Bride, which is arguably, this is a book that Bill and a colleague have edited and written a it's a very informative introduction to the novel, but the novel is seminal in the sense that it is the oldest novel published by an African-American woman that we have yet found. Is that fair? Is that the
That's
fair
right.
description?
That's right.
And it's published for the first time this week or
in
this
book
month.
Form.
In book
yeah,
form this
it
month.
Was, well, it was okay. serialized in 1865, 31 chapters, but then the author died right before she could finish the novel. The novel was still being talked about 5 years later in the same newspaper in which it first appeared, but then gradually it was forgotten. And never published as a book, and almost totally forgotten by scholars until now.
Well, I don't know where to start with it. There's so many threads to the story, so many possible points, beginning points for it, that it's hard to pick one. Maybe the most informative thing to do is to do like I do every author, is to ask the editor, tell us what you will of the story that Julia Collins, an African-American woman living in the North during Civil War time, during the end of the Civil War times, wrote in serial form for an African-American newspaper.
She was interested in writing about black women's choices. And so it's very interesting that the first African-American woman novelist says, I am going to imagine a world in which black women have real choices in the realm of their existence that in 1865, when the book came out, would have been the most important area of choice for every African-American woman, which was whom would she marry? Have to remember that in 1865, slavery, when she's publishing this novel, writing chapter by chapter, week by week, slavery has not been abolished. It's still being the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery is still being considered by various state legislatures, and they're trying to decide whether they want to do away with slavery or not. So when she writes this book, she's writing about a mother and a daughter. The mother was the slave bride of the title. She doesn't know that she's a slave and discovers that she's a slave, and she discovers this right before a man she loves and who loves her very much, the son of a New Orleans slaveholder, decides he wants to marry her. He doesn't know she's a slave, and neither does she, but when it's revealed, it makes no difference to him whatsoever. He gets a friend of his to buy her from his own father, and then the couple elope to Connecticut, where they are married by a white minister and live happily until he decides that he wants to go back to New Orleans to try to be reconciled with his father. And in the process of that effort, his father is outraged to hear his son say that he loves his wife, has no intention of casting her off, even though the father says, I'm going to disinherit you. So the father shoots his son in his rage over his son's refusal to capitulate. And the son goes to France. Not knowing that his wife, whom he left behind in Connecticut, though he intended to return to her, not knowing that his wife actually has died in childbirth. He's only told that she died, so there's no point in his going back to Connecticut. So he goes to France, but he didn't know that she died in childbirth and that he has a daughter who is subsequently raised and goes to a female seminary, gets a very fine education, doesn't know who her father or her mother were, decides to take a job as a governess. And guess where she goes to become a governess? To the home of her grandfather in New Orleans.
And she thinks she's just an ordinary white woman.
Yeah, she has no idea about her racial background, has no idea about who her mother was or her father. But interestingly, she's raised by the third significant African-American woman in the story. There's the mother, Lena Tracy, then there's the daughter, Claire Tracy, and then there's a third African-American woman whose name is Juno. And Juno, of course, is named for the goddess, Roman goddess, who protects women in marriage. And Juno is the third character in the story who really protects both of the other women, though Juno is a dark-skinned, working-class woman, whereas the two other women are lighter in color. So you have a kind of three black women in the story, and Juno takes care of Claire and also was the person who supported Claire's mother, Lena, in her final weeks of life. And Claire is the one who knows all the secrets.
Or Juno.
I'm sorry, Juno
is the...
Juno, excuse me. Juno is the one who knows all the secrets. So she plays an important role in the story as advisor and counselor and supporter. So at the end of the novel, the point at which, unfortunately, the author, Julia Collins, died, it appears that the father and the daughter are finally going to be reunited after many, many years. The daughter is finally going to find out who her father was and then presumably who her mother was.
Well, as the reader makes his or her way through the novel and through the arrival of this governess, who has this amazing family resemblance to everybody in the family, including the son who has been exiled.
Right.
So everybody from the first minute she arrives starts to notice this.
Yeah, she has a tremendously positive effect on the family and on everyone in the family except for the sister. The sister of her father, that would be her aunt, Isabel. And Isabel, of course, becomes terribly jealous of Claire, the governess, once she realizes that the visiting Count Savord from France is falling in love with Claire instead of with her, Isabel. So we have this tension that grows as the story goes along with the problem of Claire and Isabel and what is the threat that might be there. So that's another point of tension and suspense in the story.
Well, it's just it raises so many fascinating questions, and I don't want to, I don't want to be too forthcoming in telling the end of the story, although I don't know what to do in a case like this. The author is long gone, and this is, in many respects, a scholarly enterprise, so we can't talk about it unless we tell the whole story. But, I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm not going to tell the endings. I wrote the two endings that the novel has. I wrote them based on the what I've studied in many years of studying 19th century black literature and based on all that my co-editor and I could find out about Julia Collins, which includes not only her novel, but also a series of essays that she published before the novel. The essays are all included in this edition of The Curse of Caste. So everybody who reads the introduction to the book and reads the novel and reads the essays will know everything about Julia Collins that we know. So they have a perfect opportunity to think of their own endings for the book after they read the two that I propose.
Well, if you join us late, I'm talking to Bill Andrews. Professor William Andrews has released this week with the help of Oxford University Press. First publication in book form of a novel written in 1865 by an African-American woman, which was first serialized in an African-American newspaper right at the time of the end of the Civil War. And the book, in many ways, Bill Andrews, is, in my mind, is a fairy tale type mm-hmm. of book. It's the Cinderella, the Prince Charming, mm-hmm. who comes and finds a beautiful woman and takes her, notwithstanding the fact, whatever her family might be, he falls in love with her and is determined to have her. And that overcomes all caste. I mean, that sort of, in my mind, kept coming back as sort of a model for this. I bet you'd go other places to find models for this story, but it was quaint and very appealing to me for that reason.
Well, it's a great romantic story, and it has very much a great many similarities to popular women's fiction in the 19th century. That is, in this case, the most popular novels in America in the 19th century, of course, were not written by Hawthorne or Melville. They were written by white women writers who loved to write stories about young women like Claire Tracy in The Curse of Cass. That is, young women who set out to find their place in the world and who are operating under distinct disadvantages of one sort or another. Claire's disadvantage is that she doesn't know what family she has. She's really kind of alone in the world. And she feels, in a way, a certain kind of inferiority, a certain kind of inadequacy, because she can't say who she is, even though she's had this wonderful education. And so when she decides to become a governess, she's very much like the heroines of many great popular novels in 19th century America about and by women.
Jane Eyre or something.
Mm-hmm. It seems pretty clear that Julia Collins knew something about the Brontes' fiction.
Well, one of the things that stunned me was that this novel has a theme of just a little bit of black blood mm-hmm. tainting mm-hmm. an otherwise very appealing appealing young women. In this, there are two women in this case, and I had a hard time believing that a black woman, an African American woman, would write this book for other African Americans. Primarily, this is the audience of the mm-hmm. newspaper, and that the whole point of it would be wrestling with how you're going to deal with the consequences of having a little bit of black blood in you when all the readers had a lot of black blood in
mm-hmm. them. Yeah, actually, it's easy to miss the fact that there are three black women in the story. There's Lena Tracy, who is the slave bride.
But she's like one-fourth, one-eighth? She's a quadroon?
Yeah, she's a quadroon, and this is what the novelist says about her. One singular feature in Lena's beauty was her dark, rich-looking complexion. She was not a brunette, but hers was that dark brownish skin which we observe in the Spaniard and half-breed Indians. So she's not light enough to pass. She's a dark, richly complexioned woman. Her husband has no doubt about the fact that she is an African American woman. So he marries her, doesn't
well, now, let
care
me just
at all
you.
About that.
Let me just challenge you on this and help me mm-hmm. get over this, because I was under the impression reading the book that when this young Southerner whose father owns mm-hmm. a big plantation meets this young woman on a boat going up
yep.
and down the Mississippi,
yep.
and he falls in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
He does notice her, you know, her dark complexion, mm-hmm. but is not, and my impression was he was not suspicious at all that she was.
He doesn't raise the question of her race one bit. It doesn't
you think it's
interest
just,
him at all.
You think he just doesn't raise the question rather than he just thinks she's white and then is surprised later to find out that she is actually not just the daughter of a nearby plantation owner, but is the slave daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Of
Yeah, the way that the story is told is that it does not seem to register with him that she is dark, because she says, the novelist says her complexion is dark brown, like the Spaniard or the half-breed Indian. So what she's trying to suggest is that color, that is a visible admixture of color, they'd call it in the 19th century, does not have to necessarily connote African heritage. There are lots of other dark-skinned people in the United States for whom caste does not necessarily have this kind of condemning quality. So what she's trying to do in the novel, in creating these three different women of color, we might say, she's giving us a spectrum of women of color. On the lightest side, there's Claire, who is the daughter of Lena. So Claire is described by the narrator as darkly, wildly beautiful, you know. And then there's her mother, Lena, whom we're told is clearly dark-skinned. There's no question about it, but she's still beautiful and attractive as can be, and her husband loves her dearly and is willing to give up anything for her. And then even farther along the spectrum, there's Juno, who is a member of the black working class. She's a laundress. She's clearly not a light-skinned woman. She has a husband. He is a black man. They have a solid marriage. They are entirely happy together. So that the novel is not about trying to say black women ought to be able to marry white men in any reason except that in this novel, what she's really saying is that black women should be able to marry anyone whom they love. And she gives us three different options, all of which represent a black woman who has the freedom to choose.
Yeah, but the novelist thinks that light-skinned women who could pass or come close to passing, that the fulfillment of their dreams is to marry into the class in which they believe they belong or which they aspire to belong. That is to marry a white person, isn't it? And that's what kind of threw me in thinking about this novel being written for a black audience.
Well, we don't know whether Claire, the lightest of the three women, would marry or not. Of course, at the end of the story, we're left right at the end without knowing. The Count, whom we're told earlier in the story, loves her and wants to marry her, is informed by the family doctor that Claire is not completely white, that she is the product of the marriage of Richard Tracy and Lena Tracy. And as soon as the Count hears that, he says, oh, well, I'll have to think that through. It's best to face unpleasant facts squarely. So we're not sure whether the Count is really going to propose to her. Once he hears that, well, gee, you mean she's not totally white? So that's one of the things that's left in suspense at the very end of the novel. And it would be wonderful to know whether Julia Collins planned to have the Count and Claire actually marry, or whether she planned to have the Count say, I've thought about this and I don't think I want to do this. I look at Richard Tracy and his marriage to Lena and look how that ended up. You know, Lena died and Richard was shot by his father. I don't think I want to go through all of that, you know. On the other hand, it's also possible that since Julia Collins allowed one interracial marriage to take place in the story and did not portray it as an unhappy marriage, did not portray either the man or the woman as regretting for one moment that they married, Richard is willing to die for his wife. I mean, his father shoots him and he's near death, but he won't give an inch. He's going to defend his wife and his marriage, and he tells his father that slavery is the fatal nemesis of the South, and I'm glad my wife's out of the South, and I'm glad that we're not here any longer. So Richard is completely defends his wife. He's willing to die for love. His wife, of course, dies because she doesn't know what's happened to him. She doesn't die because she bewails the fact that she's not white. She dies because her husband's gone and she dies in childbirth. So there's nothing tragic about her at all. And there's nothing tragic about Claire, the daughter, either. Although there are two endings that I present, and in one of them there is a tragic end that I suggest could have been a way that Collins could have dealt with this. But once again, I come back to probably the most original character in the novel, who is Juno. She is not a mammy. She is not simple-minded. She knows more than anybody else in the story, including both of the women of color, who are Lena and Claire. She knows all sorts of stuff about them that they don't know themselves. And she is the person to whom a number of white people come and ask for information. She has dreams that turn out to be sort of telepathic. She can tell when people are coming and when they're going. And once again, she's not interested in marrying any white man. She's got a happy marriage with a black man, and it's totally fulfilled just in and of itself.
Bill, could this book, The Curse of Caste or The Slave Bride, which is being published by Oxford University Press more than 150 years after it was serialized in an African-American newspaper, could this have been written by a white woman? I mean, I'm not raising the question mm-hmm. if this one was, but mm-hmm. in the way it's written in the story format and those kinds of things, is this the kind of – what distinguishes it from the kind of literature that white women were writing at this time?
Well, I think, number one, the willingness to focus an entire story on three different black women, each of whom is distinctive. They are not – it's not that we have the tired old tragic mulatta who's miserable because she can't be white and eventually dies. There's no tragic mulatta in the story. We have three different women of color, three different colors, sort of on this color spectrum. The author is interested in each one of them for different reasons. A white woman would not have been able to do that at this time. She would have bought into stereotypes that would have been pretty much the encasing format in which each of these women would be presented. Then the other thing that is so unusual about this story is that not only does this novel feature a noticeably dark-skinned woman marrying a white man, but then they are married by a white minister who doesn't raise a question at all about the appropriateness of their marriage. And then on top of that, they go and marry in Connecticut, and they set up their marriage in Connecticut, and they're perfectly happy there. And the husband doesn't worry about what color his kids are going to be, and the wife doesn't feel guilty because she should have done this or that. And so this is totally different from the way that these miscegenation stories would have developed in the 19th century at the hands of white writers like Harriet Beecher Stowe or other such writers. If they allow for these kinds of mixed race marriages to take place, which usually they don't, there's either some tragic conclusion, some terrible thing that happens, and then everybody regrets that they got married, or else they pack them off to a foreign country because America just can't have a marriage like this.
Well, is it time for us to take a break? Gosh, Bill Andrews is telling us about his latest project, which is the publication of a novel written back in 1865 by an African-American woman, The Curse of Caste. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm talking to Professor William Andrews. Professor Andrews is the E. Maynard Adams Professor of English and Senior Associate Dean for Fine Arts and Humanities at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's in the news nationally this week because of the publication by Oxford University Press of The Curse of Caste or The Slave Bride. Now, this novel was not written by Professor Andrews, but edited by him. It was published first in 1865 in an African-American Christian newspaper. It's not fair to say that you didn't write this book, because you did write the final chapter of the book, because the author died before she completed it, and you've written two alternative endings.
And I just found the story so interesting, and the suspense and the kind of questions that are left up in the air at the end, that I thought, why not try to imagine the questions that she was wrestling with when she got to the end of the story. So what I've done, I've not tried to ventriloquize her. I'm not trying to write like her. What I've done is to say, this is how the story would end, and to lay out the kind of appraisy of the ending that just goes through the events
you
of,
give us
of each ending.
You give us permission. If we don't like your endings, we can make up one.
Well, that's one of the things that's already happened. I've had one reader tell me, well, I think the way it would end is with a way different from the way I proposed.
So. It almost makes it more fun. Some of the movies these days are giving you on the DVDs alternate endings to choose from. You're just
Charles Dickens did it when he serialized a novel and found out people didn't like his ending. Then when he brought it out in book form, he wrote a different
one. Well, Bill, this is an important book or an important event, but will raise questions in the academic community as to its significance in terms of literary history. Now, you're one of the leading experts in African American literature in the whole country here, and you're here at Chapel Hill, and you've researched, read everything you could about African American literature during this period. So it's not like you're just grabbing this out of a vacuum and saying, "Here, I found this, and I'm publishing it." So tell us how it fits and why it's important, and why others may argue with you about why you may be putting more importance on it than they would.
The book comes out in 1865, and up until this time, the claim for the first African American woman's novel is a book that came out in 1859. That book is entitled Our Nig, and it was written by a black woman named Harriet Wilson. And initially, my good friend and co-editor, Henry Louis Gates, brought out Our Nig in the early 1980s. And up until that time, people thought the first African-American novel by a woman had been published in 1892. So 1859 was quite a big jump into the antebellum
period. That was a signal event in the study of African-American literature.
Right. What the editor, Henry Louis Gates, showed when he brought Our Nig out was that Harriet Wilson really was a black woman. Nobody knew what color she was. A number of us knew about the existence of the book, but no one had done any research on her. And what Gates proved was that not only was the novel by a black woman, but the novel really, really does talk about her life. That is, the last part of Our Nig, as Gates's research showed, really corresponded to the last part of what we know, that is, what he'd been able to find out
so
about her life.
This was not exactly a novel. This was autobiographical as
very
much as
very autobiographical
fiction.
In the last one-third. He didn't know anything about the first two-thirds of the novel. Then 10 years later, another scholar brought out the fact that the whole middle section of Our Nig was not a fiction. It was actually true. She could prove who the people were, and she could line up the characters, and so we knew then, oh my gosh, the whole middle of the so-called novel is an autobiography.
Bill Andrews is going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back to continue our discussion of The Cursed Cast and why it's so important. We'll be right back. Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bill Andrews is my guest. Bill is Professor William Andrews, Associate Dean and Professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. In the news this week because of the publication of The Cursed Cast, or The Slave Bride, a novel written by an African-American woman in 1865, first published in book form this week by Oxford University Press. Bill, we've talked a lot about the story. Before we were interrupted by the break, you were pointing out how this fits in African-American literature and why it's important and why some people might think it's not as important as we might.
Now, I was talking about Our Nig and the way that it was originally presented as a novel, and how subsequent scholarship over the last 20 years keeps pointing out that it's an autobiography.
So this book, Our Nig, has been given the title or been acknowledged as the first novel written by an African-American woman, and there's no doubt it was written by an African-American woman, no doubt that it was written earlier than the book that we're talking about that you've just published, but more and more scholars believe this is an autobiography more than it is a novel, and that makes it maybe not the first novel.
More and more scholarship shows that that the heroine of Our Nig, a character called Fredo, was Harriet Wilson. And when Harriet Wilson went to publish Our Nig, what she was doing basically is saying, let me tell you the story of my life. And at the end of that book, there are three documents written by people who tell you that this book is true. You should read this book, reader, because it's true. In fact, one of them actually says that she congratulates the author for, and here I quote, writing an autobiography.
All right, I'm going to hurry us along because we're running out of time, but if you concede that this is not a novel, then are there other candidates for being the first novel?
No. There are no other candidates. There are two great books before The Curse of Caste. Our Nig is a great book. It just happens that it's not it's not a novel. It's what I call a novelized autobiography.
Right.
Reads sort of like a novel.
Anything else?
Then there's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, another autobiography. This one written by an African-American woman from Edenton, North Carolina. The most famous narrative of enslavement written by an American woman. And again, an autobiography that reads like a novel. So it and Our Nig are very similar.
So these are two important books.
Absolutely.
Written by African-American women.
Absolutely.
Prior to The Curse of Caste. But we believe now that this is, if those are not novels, but autobiographical, this is the first novel.
Yeah, that's my argument, is that somebody might find a novel by an African-American woman that's earlier than this, but there is no other text that is by an African-American woman and that we know is fiction. And that's Our Nig and Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl are true. They're true stories, and they're great stories, and everyone should read them. There's no attempt to demote their importance by saying that The Curse of Caste is the first novel.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you to give us a literary evaluation of the merits of this book that you published. We're talking to Bill Andrews about The Curse of Caste, just published in book form this week after being first published in serial form in a newspaper in 1865. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. William Andrews and I are talking about The Curse of Caste, or The Slave Narrative, a book which Bill Andrews and a colleague have edited. And Bill, we've talked a lot about it. We've got so little time. I'm just going right to it. I'm not going right to it. I picked up this book thinking, I'm going to be bored to death by this. I've got to read this book because I've got to talk to Bill Andrews about it. I couldn't put it down. I'm almost ashamed to admit it. It was written in 1865, and that time it was a fairy tale kind of book. I loved it. Now, what kind of literary merit does it have?
I think you have to take it as what it was. It was written at a time when readers wanted, number one, a good story. They wanted suspense. They wanted excitement. And she gives it to you. Every chapter, there's a certain degree of suspense as to what's coming next. So that's because she was writing for a serial. And people expected every week that there needed to be something resolved and there needed to be something unresolved. I think her characters, certainly sometimes they speak in a kind of stilted language that that no one talks that way today. So if you're looking for the kind of realism that we expect today, of course, you shouldn't read this book. You also shouldn't read Uncle Tom's Cabin. You should certainly never read Moby Dick, because the characters all talk like characters out of Shakespeare plays, you know. So at the time when Moby Dick or our Nig or Curse of Cast or Uncle Tom's Cabin was written, people weren't looking for characters to sound like other people. They were looking for characters whom they could identify with in some way based on the way that they talked, the way that they behaved, their aspirations and goals in life. And so I think that for this author, she was looking to inspire her readers. Remember, she's writing for a national black newspaper. She's especially looking to inspire her black women readers with images of black women that are really positive. Why? Because the image of black women in 1865 is so uniformly negative in the popular culture, popular journalism, and so on.
These were black women in 1865 who were readers. These were people
absolutely
who could read. And yet, notwithstanding that, because of the times, you're arguing that African-American women had low self-esteem or low self-image.
Well, what I'm arguing is that if they read the way black women are portrayed in the standard media of the time, they're going to read almost uniformly derogatory portrayals of black women. And they're not going to see what black women portrayed as women who are fully deserving of marriage partners who love them and whom they love and whom they should be able to marry
so
for that reason.
That was why Christian Recorder published this every week. Their readers were telling them, we love this. And the reason the women, African-American women, loved it was because they felt sympathy and they felt like this showed the kind of women that they really could be if times improved.
And that's universal in popular literature. Why do people read Danielle Steele? You know, why do they read the popular authors today? It's because these authors give them versions of themselves that they would like to be, that they would like to identify with. And so when Julia Collins gives her readership these three different African American women, all of whom marry for love, all of whom are happy with their choices. That's assuming that Claire would get a chance to marry in the end. The Count, who we already talked about, maybe he will and maybe he won't propose to her. But let's suppose he does, and let's suppose she chooses him. What Collins wanted to say was every African-American woman ought to be able to marry for love. She should have that freedom. It's a new day. The slavery is coming to an end. Let's imagine a world in which black women can really have that choice and act on the strengths and their ideals. And so that's what she gives us.
Well, I could ask you 100 questions about the book, and it's a great book. One of the other things that excites me is having a friend who is having his 15 seconds of fame this week, because he is at the center of, you know, an important literary event. And are you enjoying it, or is this are you a shy college professor who doesn't like to get all this attention?
Well, I'm enjoying it because I get to talk about Julia Collins, and Julia Collins has been forgotten for too long. So it's fun to be able to say, think about this woman who may very well have been only 22 years old when she wrote this book, and who I believe knew from the time she started writing it that she was dying.
Wow. Well, we here in Chapel Hill, we celebrate with Professor William Andrews the publication by Oxford University Press of The Curse of Caste or The Slave Bride, a book that Professor Andrews and a colleague edited, and because the author died before it was completed, Bill Andrews has written two versions of the last chapter. Now, it's important in academic worlds. I have to say, it's also a good read. So consider buying this book and reading it. Thanks to all of y'all for listening. Thanks to Bill Andrews for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to Ron Sutz for helping us. And I'll be back same time tomorrow.